evening. Tim offered some guys some options of which angle to tackle on excavating these aspects of Jesus and his life and who he is. And I started looking through them and I thought, okay, I want to teach humility because I really don't think I've ever taught it before in a classroom setting. I've used it a lot as motivation and challenge in professional settings, but I don't think I'd ever taught it in a class. And so I started browsing through it and I started realizing, man, humility, even though the word's not there, it's from Genesis to Revelation. It's everywhere in the Bible. I thought, oh, well, this is about the humility of Jesus. Okay, that's going to be easier. All through Jesus' life is humility. And so it began to be somewhat intimidating. I thought, what am I going to do with this? I've only got 45 minutes. And so I thought, all right, I could take, you know, one example of the life of Christ here in one teaching, and I could excavate that, and we like to call that exegesis, and find out, you know, what's going on in the background in the original language and all that, unpack it, so to speak. But then I thought, no, that might not do it justice, because there's so much there. You know, what do I do? Touch on everything that's there, or just focus on one little story? Well, I'm going to introduce this class with one or two little stories. But then what I want us to do is to realize that this is the essence of who Jesus is and who we are to be in relationship with him. This isn't just an exercise that we do. This isn't just something that God imparts on us or assigns to us, and we find a moment to really go out and show a lot of humility. But it's an overall posture that defines who we are to be, and it certainly defines who Jesus is. We struggle with that. And we're going to see that his disciples struggled with that. And so let's look at the first example, Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9. We're going to look at verses 46 to 48. An argument arose among them, being the disciples, as to which of them was the greatest. But Jesus, knowing the reasoning of their hearts, took a child and put him by his side and said to them, "He who receives this child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For he who is least among you all is the one who is great." One of the many things Jesus taught that wouldn't make sense to them on the front end. After all, a small child seemed like pretty much nothing in Jewish culture. A child had an abrupt change in life with regard to responsibilities. Now, especially males, when they hit puberty, they have an abrupt change, and females do too, but in the Jewish culture, it's almost like they'd had very few responsibilities, but then when they went through that year and their muscles were growing and they were beginning to get a little bit of facial hair and that sort of thing, then they were given a whole lot of responsibility. They were not regarded as emotionally mature at all, but physically mature to go about doing manly tasks and manly chores. And so this child that Jesus is talking about, whether it's male or female, is likely a very, very young child. And so the idea of this child being greatest isn't going to be easily understood by them. In fact, I think that they're going to have increased resistance because just a few verses before, they've seen the power that comes and the adulation that comes from the exercise of the greatness of the power of casting a demon out of a boy. And perhaps this was a young, really young boy too. And so maybe they're thinking, what about this power? And then in the very next story that's told, they're aware that somebody else is going around casting out demons. in the name of Jesus. And they went and tried to run this person off, get him to stop doing that. But Jesus said, no, if they're not against you, they're for you. And I wonder why they were doing that. Does that tell us a little bit of the motivation behind asking who is the greatest? Maybe they saw themselves of this group of disciples, unique disciples, as being greater than everyone else because, you know, they were followers of Jesus and he could do all of these mighty things. I don't know, but that's interesting. So this is definitely a challenge. Now let's go on to Luke chapter 22. And I want to read verses 24 through 30. A dispute also arose among them as to which of them was to be regarded as the greatest. It's not as if we haven't heard that before, is it? It's happening again. And he said to them, the kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and those in authority over them are called benefactors. But not so with you. Rather, let the greatest among you become as the youngest, and the leader as one who serves. For who is the greater, one who reclines at a table or one who serves? Is it not the one who reclines at a table? But I am among you as the one who serves. You are those who have stayed with me in my trials, and I assign to you, as my Father assigned to me, a kingdom, that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. So he's telling them, yes, they can be great. They can kind of occupy a throne with Jesus by a certain definition of the word, but their greatness isn't going to be based on where they sit at the table. Their greatness is going to be based on whether or not they serve. Whether or not they have a spirit of humility. And to me, I think the key verse here is verse 27 at the very last sentence, but I am among you as the one who serves. Now, Jesus has been serving all along, but they still have this perspective of the greatness as not being service-oriented. And, of course, we are familiar with another story in the gospel of where the visitors to the home wanted to sit at the head of the table, and Jesus rebuked them, but he lifted up the least expected ones in the eyes of the rest of the crowd as to who might be lifted up by a rabbi, by this king-to-be. And the reception that Jesus got in doing that wasn't that warm, was it? And so Jesus is telling them, I am one who serves. Well, they had some excavating to do there, because even though they had hung around Jesus for a period of time, even though they had traveled with him, and they're preparing to go on a very consequential journey with him in the not-too-distant future to Jerusalem, and they're really not knowing who he is. I remember a wife told me one time of a couple I was working with, you know, I dated him 6 years and I thought I knew him. And then we got married. You can really think you know someone, but you really don't. You really don't know what makes them tick. Jesus definitely had an appealing quality to them. He had already inspired them to make sacrifices and leave some very valuable treasures behind in order to follow him. So he definitely had value that they saw. And the signs and wonders were certainly a part of it. I can't help but think that his person, his demeanor, were also a part of that, because he would certainly be affirming them and lifting them up as well as challenging them. But really knowing who he is as the one who serves. Now, I've got a real challenge before me, and I've selected about 14 or 15 verses to go through from the Gospel of John. And the Gospel of John is going to tell us who Jesus is. And I've had to pare this down. I don't want to run out of time. Now watch me be so sensitive about running out of time that I finish early. Wouldn't that be something? But I'm so concerned about not being able to get the material in that I've had to pare things down. Now, what these verses are going to tell us are about the nature of Jesus' relationship to his Father. You know, the apple in some ways doesn't fall very far from the tree, but fathers and their sons are not exactly alike, even though they may be one in a particular essence. So, all of these verses will address that aspect of who Jesus is, how he sees himself in relationship to his Father. Now, I want you to notice in about two-thirds of these verses, probably around 10 of them, you're going to hear the negative terms of not or nothing. And this is going to tell us a lot of how Jesus sees himself. Now, this is, keep in mind, this is coming from the Messiah. This is coming from our King and how he, our Savior, and how he sees himself in relationship to his Father. Because if we want to grasp humility in Jesus, we have to, at least to the extent that our hearts are open enough, see how just how humble he is before his Father. The first passage is John chapter 4 and verse 34. Jesus said to them, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work." So Jesus' food, what sustains him, what is his foundation, what nourishes him, is to do the will of the Father who sent him. John chapter 5 and verse 19. So Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of his own accord, but only what he sees the Father doing." Now, this is our King. This is our Savior. And he says he can't do anything on his own. The only thing he says he can do is what he sees his Father doing, or what his Father tells him to do. Anything, only. These are pretty accurate translations, I'm told, with regard to the Greek language. Those are very strong terms, aren't they? So imagine a king saying he can't do anything without his Father's will being a part of it. Same chapter, John chapter 5, verse 30. "I can do nothing on my own. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is just, because I seek not my own will, but the will of him who sent me." Once again, he can do nothing on his own. He says he can judge, but later on we're going to see that he can judge because his Father gives him the power to judge. He can't do anything of himself. He's completely dependent on his Father. Chapter 5 and verse 41, still in the same chapter. "I do not receive glory from people, but I know that you do not have the love of God within you. I have come in my Father's name, and you do not receive me." His purpose in being there is the name of his Father. Let's move on a chapter to John chapter 6 and verse 38. Well, actually, I'm going to begin in verse 36. But I said to you that you have seen me and yet do not believe. All that the Father gives me will come to me, and whoever comes to me I will never cast out. For I have come down from heaven, not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. We're not even a third of the way through yet of just the verses that I've picked out. Keep in mind, there are more. John chapter 7, verse 16. So Jesus answered them, "My teaching is not mine, but his who sent me." Same chapter, chapter 7 and verse 28. So Jesus proclaimed as he taught in the temple, "You know me, and you know where I come from, but I have not come of my own accord. He who sent me is true, and him you do not know." Next chapter, John chapter 8, also verse 28. So Jesus said to them, "When you have lifted up the Son of Man, then you will know that I am he, and that I do nothing on my own authority, but speak just as the Father taught me." And then he goes on to talk about how he's not alone because his Father is with him. Same chapter, verse 42. Jesus said to them, "If God were your Father, you would love me, for I came from God and I am here, and I came not of my own accord, but he sent me." Same chapter, verses 49 and 50. Jesus answered, "I do not have a demon, but I honor my Father, and you dishonor me. Yet I do not seek my own glory. There is one who seeks it, and he is the judge." Let's go to chapter 10. First, we'll read verse 15. "Just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep." He's talking about how the Father knows him and he knows the Father. Let's move on down to verse 30. "I and the Father are one." Now, isn't that interesting? I want you to remember this verse. Jesus says he is nothing without his Father. He's totally dependent on his Father. He doesn't do anything unless his Father tells him to do it. But yet they're one. This challenges us with the popular paradigm of leadership and submission, doesn't it? Now, when I say that, you might be thinking, "Oh no, here goes Danny on that topic again. I know I talk about it a lot. I'm going to talk about it a little bit more a little bit later. So please indulge me." But I think it's a crucial, crucial theme for our time. Because we're learning from who Jesus is, after all. We're trying to excavate who he is. John chapter 14 and verse 10. "Do you not believe that I am in the Father, and the Father is in me? The words that I say to you, I do not speak on my own authority, but the Father who dwells in me does his works." Next chapter, chapter 15 and verse 10. "If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. Okay. So the challenge for us here is trying to appreciate who Jesus is. And it seems logical intellectually on the front end. And on the front end, we might be thinking, what's wrong with these disciples? Because Jesus has repeatedly said over and over and over again, I get the impression he has made these kinds of statements about his relationship to the Father and his dependence on the Father everywhere he went, every time he taught. We're just given some specific examples, but I think it was a regular feature, and most scholars do too, of his message. He's totally dependent on his Father. All right, we've already read 15 verses, and there are more in John. What was the last chapter that I read from you where they were still struggling over who was the greatest? It's 22. They're not getting it. They're looking at Jesus, and yes, they love him. Yes, they're still willing to bear some burdens for him. But there's this thing called human nature that's a result of sin. Now, we're not born sinning. That's not what I'm saying. But it almost becomes natural for us after we first sin in our own era of accountability that sin just comes so easily to us. And here they've seen Jesus and they've heard Jesus say over and over and over and over again, ad nauseum, I'm nothing without my Father. And they might think, well, that's nice. You know, maybe he doesn't think too highly of himself, but they're not absorbing this enough to get a sense that this is his essence. This is a part of his defining feature. And they're supposed to imitate that. Because here they come arguing again over who is going to be the greatest. But there's a sense in which I can sympathize with them. Let's try to relate to the disciples. How many of us have wanted to be and have made a commitment to be the very best at our chosen profession? You know, I've been in more than one profession. And I've had the desire to be the best. Bet you have too. I was originally a music teacher. I wanted to be the best choral conductor. One of the things that's interesting about choral music and the people that are in it, Dr. Sharon, who was my major professor at Fried-Hardeman, took me to a concert in Jackson, and we were hearing this world-renowned chorale, and the conductor was very famous. He said, Danny, I want to tell you something about this guy, because you'll probably hear some things about him that are true, and I want you to know the rest of the choral society is not like him. He said, all this guy is a dirty old man. He's just a self-absorbed, dirty old man. Very gifted musician. He said, you're going to hear that tonight. An incredible musician, just a dirty old man. He said, but most of the people in our business are very humble. And he's talking about choral conductors, because musicians have this reputation of being very egocentric. You know, prima donnas, you know, like the attention. We like to look good in front of other people. And it's been nice to see that so many of our very best choral conductors in this country really are very humble people. But most of us have a desire to be the best. Even in church, if we teach, we want to teach the best we can. If we preach, we want to preach the best we can. If we lead singing, for all of you and myself who do, we want to do the best we can. And there's not anything wrong with that as long as it's motivated by service, as long as it's motivated by humility. But how many of us, and all of us are guilty, have experienced this, boy, I would like to look good up there. Now, we would never say it like that because of how it might make me look. There's never anything like that in Jesus. You know, if Jesus participated in the athletics of his day, maybe he engaged in some competition of sorts, I don't know. But if he did, he didn't do it to make himself look good. because it just wasn't a part of who he was or continues to be. We want to make the best grades. If we can get that 4.0, we can look pretty good. It can look pretty good on a job application. It can look pretty good on a resume. Well, that's okay if those wonderful grades are prompted by a sense of service instead of self-glorification. And so now that we're all sitting in here feeling mighty guilty, because we've all been guilty of this, let's look at where this began, actually. Let's go to Genesis chapter 3. I'll read just the first few verses. Now the serpent was more crafty than any other beast of the field that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, "Did God actually say, 'You shall not eat of any tree in the garden?'" And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God said, 'You shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden. Neither shall you touch it, lest you die.'" But the serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die. For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." And so she succumbed to that temptation. But what was the temptation? Being like God, knowing what God knows, knowing the difference between good and evil. You see, in the garden, total dependence on God was just a natural part of every second of their lives. It was defined by humility before God. God was everything. They were nothing. Well, they were important because of the value that God placed in them. But then Satan comes along and he starts introducing pride into the picture. And now that pride is in the picture, humility starts to go away. And there's the desire to be like the one who leads them. They will no longer be one with God in the way that they were. Now they're going to be separated from God. They were one with God while they were in submission to his leadership. But now they've lost the relationship, and the whole redemptive process has to begin. All beginning with a lack of humility, more of a sense of serving self instead of serving another. This is where it all began, and this has been the struggle of human nature since then. Now, what I want us to do is in pondering who Jesus is. Well, yeah, I think I've got time to do this. Is to try to appreciate that Jesus' nature, his submissive nature, is eternal. I wish I had time to just share with you every verse that Wayne Grudem has come across. You can go to waynegrudem.com and look this up on the eternal nature of Jesus to his Father, in relationship to his Father. There is a very dangerous doctrine going around right now that says that Jesus really never was in submission to his Father until he left the presence of the Father and the Spirit in the heavenly realm and then came down to earth to save man. That Jesus did not lack authority, that he had equal authority, that he did not have a submissive role, that because they were one, they interpret oneness as being just alike. Well, even when Jesus was on earth being submissive, he said they were one. So you would think that would do away with that argument. It's becoming fairly popular. Now, why do you think this position is becoming very popular? I think it's because Satan is fooling us into thinking that submission is a position of inferiority. It's a position of weakness. There is no power in submission. When I believe ultimately there's grand power in submission. And it's taking its form in, I guess, the most prominent issue that we would be familiar with would be gender roles. And its intent is to water down the existence of gender roles. When he's got 17 pages of verses of how Jesus was in submission to the Father before the creation of the world, during the creation of the world, but before he came down to earth to become flesh, while he was on earth, after he was resurrected, but while he was still on earth, and then after he's gone back to be with the Father, after the ascension, he is still in submission to his Father. And so the spirit of these verses, these 15 verses that I have just read you, have been an ongoing feature of Jesus' identity that never has changed and never will change. So I mentioned there were 17 pages. Let's look at two verses that I think are very powerful, but two out of dozens more. Let's go to Revelation chapter 2. Revelation chapter 2 and verse 26. The one who conquers and who keeps my works until the end. This is as if it's God the Father talking. To him will I give authority over the nations. So in conquering to the end, God is still going to give Christ authority over the nations. This is after the ascension. But my favorite is from 1 Corinthians chapter 15, where the resurrection has been under discussion. So let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. I want to read verses 24 through 28. 1 Corinthians 15. Then comes the end, when he delivers the kingdom to God, the Father, after destroying every rule and every authority and power. Let me read that again. Then comes the end, when he delivers the kingdom to God the Father after destroying every rule and every authority and every power, for he must reign until he has put all his enemies under his feet. The last enemy to be destroyed is death. So Christ has a lot of power, right? He's been talking about the power of Jesus. Well, notice the next sentence. For God has put all things in subjection under his feet. But when it says all things are put in subjection, it is plain that he is accepted who put all things in subjection under him. When all things are subjected to him, then the Son himself will also be subjected to him who put all things in subjection under him, that God may be all in all. Yes, everything is a subjection under Jesus because God has made it that way. And Jesus continues to view God as being all in all. The nature of Jesus is not changing. But if we try to change the nature of Jesus in a way that waters down his humility, where it doesn't become an eternal foundational feature of who he is, that's a very dangerous and potentially very destructive thing. We don't need humility watered down in our lives. We need it lifted up. It needs to be glaringly obvious. We need more humility in our parenting. And by that, I don't mean giving in to our kids. I mean a spirit of humility while maintaining firm boundaries. We need more humility in our marriages. We need more humility in our congregations and in our neighborhoods. We need more humility across the board, because jealousies and covetousness and wanting someone else has is so much a part of what so many people have. And if they have been taught to view Jesus as being not as humble as he is, then think of how they can rationalize their own lives into a posture of self-service instead of service to others. You see how dangerous this doctrine is? It's really dangerous. And it really, really does damage to the marital dynamic, to where there's equal power in leadership and submission. I don't usually do this in classes. I think in all the years I've taught here, I may have done this 5 or 6 times. But I want to read an essay by a gentleman who lived a long time ago. And when I read this, you'll tell that his language is a bit older than our style. His name's Andrew Murray. He was born in the early 1800s in South Africa. But he had very strong religious interests, and so he somehow, I don't know how, but made his way into very strong Protestant Reformation territory in Central Europe. And he studied there. And he took everything that he learned there and went back to South Africa, wrote something around 50 books, like 240, 250 articles, writing something all the time. If you're interested in looking him up, he has, in fact, we could teach a whole class on this, and I'm tempted to do it. He's got the beauty of humility and holiness subdivided into 12 or 13 different categories. And what I'm going to read to you comes from that. Now, I know that we've worked today and we're tired, and what he's going to write is rather lofty, but I want you to put your thinking caps on and pay very close attention. His style is a little challenging, and it's highly intellectual, but it's very simple and profound at the same time. Pay very close attention to what I read to you, because he highlights the humility of Jesus and the humility that we are to exude far better than I ever could, okay? So these are the words of Andrew Murray. And he quotes Revelation 4:2 to begin. "They shall cast their crowns before the throne, saying, 'Worthy art thou, O Lord our God, to receive the glory and the honor and the power. For thou didst create all things, and because of thy will they were and were created.'" So he's going to say they were created. He's going to identify mankind as the creature. So when you hear the word creature, meaning the created by God, he's referring to mankind. "When God created the universe, it was with one object of making the creature partaker of his perfection and blessedness, and so showing forth in it the glory of his love and wisdom and power. God wished to reveal himself in and through created beings by communicating to them as much of his own goodness and glory as they were capable of receiving. But this communication was not a giving to the creature something that it could possess in itself, a certain life or goodness of which it had the charge and disposal. By no means. But as God is the ever-living, ever-present, ever-acting one, who upholdeth all things by the word of his power, and in whom all things exist, the relation of the creature to God could only be one of unceasing, absolute, universal dependence. As truly as God by his power once created, so truly by that same power must God every moment maintain. The creature has not only to look back to the origin and first beginning of existence and acknowledge that it there owes everything to God. Its chief care, its highest virtue, its only happiness now and through all eternity is to present itself an empty vessel in which God can dwell and manifest his power and goodness. The life God bestows is imparted not once for all, but each moment continuously by the unceasing operation of his mighty power. Humility, the place of entire dependence on God, is from the very nature of things the first duty and the highest virtue of the creature, and the root of every virtue. And so pride, or the loss of this humility, is the root of every sin and evil. It was when the now fallen angels began to look upon themselves with self-complacency that they were led to disobedience and were cast down from the light of heaven into outer darkness. Even so it was when the serpent breathed the poison of his pride, the desire to be as God, into the hearts of our first parents, that they too fell from their high estate into all the wretchedness in which man is now sunk. In heaven and earth, pride, self-exaltation is the gate and the birth and the curse of hell. Hence it follows that nothing can be our redemption but the restoration of the lost humility, the original and only true relation of the creature to its God. And so Jesus came to bring humility back to earth, to make us partakers of it, and by it to save us. In heaven, he humbled himself to become a man. The humility we see in him possessed him in heaven. It brought him, he brought it from there. Here on earth, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death. His humility gave his death its value, and so became our redemption. And now the salvation he imparts is nothing less and nothing else than a communication of his own life and death, his own disposition and spirit, his own humility as the ground and root of his relation to God and his redeeming work. Jesus Christ took the place and fulfilled the destiny of man as a creature by his life of perfect humility. His humility is our salvation. His salvation is our humility. And so the life of the saved ones, of the saints, must needs bear this stamp of deliverance from sin and full restoration to their original state. Their whole relation to God and man marked by an all-pervading humility. Without this, there can be no true abiding in God's presence or experience of his favor and the power of his Spirit. This is reminding me of the humility of baptism. Without this, no abiding faith or love or joy or strength. Humility is the only soil in which the graces root. The lack of humility is the sufficient explanation of every defect and failure. Humility is not so much a grace or a virtue along with others. It is the root of all, because it alone takes the right attitude before God and allows him as God to do all. God has so constituted us as reasonable beings that the truer the insight into the real nature or the absolute need of a command, the readier and fuller will be our obedience to it. The call to humility has been too little regarded in the church because its true nature and importance has been too little apprehended, just like those disciples. It is not a something which we bring to God or he bestows. It is simply the sense of entire nothingness, the word of Jesus, which comes when we see how truly God is all, and in which we make way for God to be all. When the creature realizes that this is the true nobility and consents to be with his will, his mind, and his affections, the form, the vessel in which the life and glory of God are to work and manifest themselves, he sees that humility is simply acknowledging the truth of his position as creature and yielding to God his place. I'm almost done, but here's my favorite paragraph. It's the next to the last one. In the life of earnest Christians, of those who pursue and profess holiness, humility ought to be the chief mark of their uprightness. It is often said that it is not so, and that's probably true. May not one reason be that in the teaching and example of the church, it has never had that place of supreme importance which belongs to us, to it? And that this again is owing to the neglect of this truth, as strong as sin is as a motive to humility, there is one of still wider and mightier influence, that which makes the angels, that which made Jesus, that which makes the holiest of saints in heaven so humble. That the first and chief mark of the relation of the creature, the secret of his blessedness, is the humility and nothingness which leaves God free to be all. I want to read that last line again. There is one of still wider and mightier influence, that which makes the angels, that which made Jesus, that which makes the holiest of saints in heaven so humble, that the first and chief mark of the relation of the creature, the secret of his blessedness, is the humility and nothingness which leaves God free to be all. Wow. I am sure there are many Christians who will confess that their experience has been very much like my own in this, that we had long known the Lord without realizing that meekness and lowliness of heart are to be the distinguishing feature of the disciple as they were of the Master, meaning Jesus. And further, that this humility is not a thing that will come of itself, but that it must be made the object of special desire and prayer and faith and practice. As we study the Word, we shall see what every distinct and often repeated instructions Jesus gave to his disciples on this point, and how slow they were in understanding him. Let us, at the very commencement of our meditations, admit that there is nothing so natural to man, nothing so insidious and hidden from our sight, nothing so difficult and dangerous as pride. Let us feel that nothing but a very determined and persevering waiting on God and Christ will discover how lacking we are in the grace of humility and how impotent to obtain what we seek. Let us study the character of Christ until our souls are filled with the love and admiration of his lowliness. And let us believe that when we are broken down under a sense of our pride and our impotence to cast it out, Jesus Christ himself will come in to impart this grace to as a part of his wondrous life in us. Just about done. I'm not going to read these verses, but I'll bring to your attention 1 Corinthians 13. He's talked about the superiority of love all the way through the chapter, faith, hope, and love, but the greatest of these is love. In a position of submission, that person can love just as much as a person in authority. Therefore, they have access to that greatest power. Zechariah 4:6, he's talking about rebuilding the temple. He says, not going to be power and might, not physical might, not intellectual might, not decision-making power, but by the Spirit of his living, of the living God. So whether or not you're in a role of leadership and submission, we are all filled with the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, that Spirit of love that resembles who Jesus is. Just think, if we could be as submissive as Jesus is, think about how powerful we could be.